Hello, everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. I got an incredible guest, someone I'm very biased towards. She's our very own contributing editor, fusion analyst here at CrushTheStreet.com, Trader Steph, returning guest to the podcast, to the program. And if you want to check out her latest articles and the archived articles, visit CrushTheStreet.com, click on her name, and you'll see everything that she's ever written for us here at Crush the Street. We're going to be getting into some critical numbers regarding gold, things that we've talked about in the past that have come to pass. And then we've seen gold blow right through, silver, same thing. And then we're going to be having a real conversation about what's gone on in 2020 and the implications as we round out the year, go through the elections, and enter 2021. So without any further ado, Trader Steph, thanks for coming on Crush the Street with me.
Hey, Ken, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to just, before, I know we're going to get into some live charts and look at the price of gold and silver, but I'd like to point out your call on 1380 gold when gold passed that number, the significance of what gold was going to do. And same thing with silver. I mean, you've been talking about the 2149 as the 2016 high in silver and the significance of that. And sure enough, we saw that number get absolutely obliterated with silver blasting off past it. So maybe just touch on that before we get into some of the other things in our interview.
Yeah, we're definitely in a bull run, eh? That 1380 was very stubborn for several years. And we'll go through that on the live chart. And the same with silver. There was that 2149 Fibonacci, which the 1380 was also a Fibonacci number. And we finally blew that out. And there was a space of an hour once it took that out where we had a repo move, you know, a buck in less than an hour. It's pretty amazing. So we'll see that on the live charts when it's shown.
That's great. Well, we'll definitely get into that. Let's start off with, you know, you've really covered what was going on with COVID, the pandemic, the illness, talking about the severity of the illness. You've shared that here on Crush the Street, and we've talked about, you know, what that would mean for the economy and what we're seeing now. I mean, you wrote an incredible article on New York, what's happening in New York, how it's turning into an absolute hellhole, and let's start off with what's going on with the illness.
Yeah, well, it's a long story, so I'll do the best I can here for everyone. Please follow along. It's got a beginning, middle, and end. So, you know, the pandemic, the first article I published over on Crush the Street was on January 21st. SARS 2.0, coronavirus superbug threatened stock market and global economy. And the most prescient follow-up, in my opinion, was a harvester of sorrow. First wave of the SARS 2.0 coronavirus. And I first published that on Crush the Street on February 7th. And there's still a thread running over on Twitter, by the way. So, you know, I've had a personal interest in this pandemic. It's kind of weird. But because of my dad passing away, and he was buried in Arlington a year ago this month, actually, and it wasn't due to his numerous underlying conditions and a dozen medications, but because of a MRSA bacterial superbug that invaded his body and compromised his immune system, which resulted in a 3-year struggle with bacterial, viral, and fungal infections. Hmm. And that entered his body following, that was after his second leg was amputated. And the death certificate stated sepsis as the cause of death. But that was because that was an infection of the bloodstream, which was caused by, you know, then his major organs shut down, but that originated from the MRSA infection, and that's what the sepsis was. So it was the MRSA that killed him, actually not the sepsis. That was just like an afterthought. So let's cut to the chase, and let's try and eliminate a few rabbit holes. So, you know, the dominant factor in the current global economic woes is the pandemic. Obviously, it's all we seem to talk about lately. And there's a global second wave of the SARS-CoV-2, otherwise known as COVID, and I'll call it COVID from this point forward, has shown its first warning signs. since early September. And its characteristics do not necessarily mirror all the documented dynamics from previous novel virus pandemics, because the world is more connected and the travel and communications. But its virulence with record daily cases has emerged across the Northern Hemisphere, including Asia. And all of the US states as of yesterday are now experiencing sustained increases in lab confirmed cases, and or they're breaking new daily records. It depends on where you're at. And also in Europe and the UK, where new countrywide localized restrictions and or lockdowns are being implemented. And Israel was the first country to implement a countrywide lockdown that's lasting for about 3 weeks. So the gene sequences, which I've got up on the screen right now, it's the GSED database. And I want everyone to look on the top left where you've got those color-coded squares. The ones that are kind of blue and green, that's the Italian strain. The ones on the right that are yellow and red, that's the Wuhan strain. So you're basically looking at like a corporate flow chart of all the gene sequences that became available in this database. So it tracks what happens. So the entire planet is now seeded with the Italian strain, which mutated from the original Wuhan strain, manifested a global epidemic hotspots that are characteristic of a herald wave, otherwise known as a first wave, which is, you know, when a novel virus establishes itself and it adapts to its new human host population. And it doesn't have any immunity. You know, we don't have immunity, and there wasn't any medicinal intervention available when it really began to surface. So a coronavirus shows small mutations within its 30,000 lines of code versus a flu, which only has 10, with every infected person. But eventually it adapts to a higher degree, and then you can have a mutation of significant consequence, which occurred like back in Italy. So I'm gonna throw my mouse over the first red dot down here, and you can see where it says Italy. That's where it first began to exit Wuhan and begin to spread and then go on its trek to go into the different colors up here, and the light blues, the light greens, and the dark blues. So it's really clear. It's not something you can argue with. So let's be very clear about this. There's no gene sequence evidence at this time, despite what you may have heard with studies written about in the news, that COVID is any more or less virulent. When it was in the G-clad mutation in Italy back in February, that strain has moved in and taken over all other strains globally, which brought the herald wave to the US East Coast, by the way, unbeknownst to the US task force, who were initially focused on a few West Coast Wuhan strain cases and waiting for some kind of community spread, while at the same time, it was busy seeding the US, Europe, Africa and South America, so on and so on. So, you know, the Eastern Asian countries are dealing with their first taste of the Italian strain lineage, and they're scared to death of it. And, you know, because it can incur a lot of deaths. So China locked down an eastern port city of 9 million people last week. I think you probably heard about it. They only had a cluster of 12 cases, and they proceeded to test all 9 million people. So over the last few months, there's been numerous areas in China, for instance, including a province just outside of Beijing, where the same extreme measures were taken, and that contained the spread. By testing, tracing, isolation. That's the same thing that happened with SARS 1.0 in 2003. It just didn't burn out by itself. It was contained. So look, if a gene sequence release begin to show any significant mutation that requires like a new clade assignment, they give it another letter, that would be a lagging indicator because it would already be circulating in the population. So we could be in for a bigger problem than expected as we venture into the winter. But look, deaths are currently subdued despite the rise in caseloads, you know, but that has more to do with demographics, the antiviral cocktails, improved protocols of treatment, you know, back, but if the case load begins to overload the medical infrastructures, we're back to a situation that you know, like Italy and the US was back in March and April, along with the potential of a more virulent strain because of the huge reservoir of virus that's already out there. So there's a major issue with COVID, and it's called ADE, and it's antibody dependent enhancement. In other words, in layman terms, it means it uses antibodies to enter cells. And since it's a coronavirus, it evolves at a much higher pace than, say, the seasonal flu, which is why we've never had a coronavirus, otherwise known as the common cold, vaccine. So the type of antibodies that actually neutralize COVID are showing an immunity that's only less than 4 months. And as a side note, you know, the vaccine front runners, they're using the original gene sequence out of Wuhan and not the most recent lineages out of, you know, Italy. And Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly have all been halted due to various issues. And the antiviral cocktails, otherwise known as monocolloidal antibodies, like Remdesivir and Regeneron, may work initially, but not in the long term for what I just mentioned. And that is what appears to be happening with temporary immunity and people get reinfected. So there is a distinct difference between antibodies that are developed that fight the initial viral load versus antibodies that actually neutralize the virus, which can take up to weeks to develop and show in the body. So, you know, there's one metric that's aligning very close to the 1918 pandemic. And I've got a graph up there. And this is one of the original graphs that they, you know, they had a different way of doing things. They didn't have computers, obviously. They didn't have the communications worldwide that we currently have. But this is the best we can do. And the metric is death. And look, in only 8 months, the virus has taken 222,000 souls just in the US as of today. And that's an undercount. And it's estimated that it's up to 30% higher versus the 675,000 in 30 months from 1918 to 1920, when all was said and done, that died. So keep in mind, in 1918, when the pandemic occurred, there was no modern medical infrastructure or the medicinal advances, you know, we're fortunate to have today. But take note of the line for Germany. You know, the initial little bump back in June and July in the summer, late spring, early summer, there was a second wave, not a second wave, but a continuation of the Herald wave with a bump up, specifically in Berlin. So that's kind of like a segue into what happened in the United States this summer. And you know, that's a rabbit hole. But I recommend that folks utilize worldometer.info for their information. And this is just a quick screenshot. I don't want to get into the details of this, but I sorted it by deaths per 1 million population. And you'll notice all the talk about Sweden, it's actually number 14 on the list. Okay. So let's look.
Yeah, go ahead. Are you going to continue or were you taking a...
Yeah, I'm going to continue.
Okay.
Then lead into the economy.
Yeah, no, I wasn't sure. Please proceed.
So the U.S. is currently averaging about 1,000 deaths per day. That's one per minute. And there are 50,000 new PCR lab confirmed cases every single day. That's the average right now. And that caseload is double the rate that we had during the Herald wave through the spring and midsummer. Midsummer was just a continuation of the Herald wave. And we're closing in on the July 24th peak of 79,000 cases pretty fast. So, you know, it's really not looking good. And when we consider, drop down menu up here keeps popping in my way from Zoom. There we go, I'm sorry. So despite what you may have heard, You don't isolate the virus with a PCR lab confirmed test because only a small section of the gene sequence code that specifically identifies COVID already exists. And it also differentiates between seasonal flu or any other coronavirus that might be floating around, as well as lag time between initial exposure and symptoms and recovery or death. People are most infectious days before any symptoms even present themselves. So let's talk about that other canard, and that would be comorbidities and underlying conditions, right? Look, recent headlines and some armchair pundits have been irresponsible in leading people to believe that 99% of deaths are due solely to an underlying condition, as though those people would have or would not have died is just all conjecture. Look, the majority...
That's such, and I'll just make a comment there. It's almost heartless when someone says they had an underlying condition, so they got COVID and you know, therefore they should have died. I mean, if you're 85 and you're weak, you're not going to put that person in the next LA marathon and have them run 24 miles and go, oh, well, they were old. They died. Right. I mean, you're not going to have them do that.
Yeah, it's really irresponsible, but you know, that's human nature. And, you know, this is a developing situation. So as time goes on, we learn more about it. So we don't have all the answers, but, you know, we got some data now and we're improving, you know, how we're handling this. But, you know, 60% of the U.S. population has at least one underlying condition, which is more often than not obesity. And that's not because you're visually overweight. You know, that means that your body mass, you got more fat on your body than you have muscle. And muscle weighs a lot more and takes up less space than fat, by the way. So I want to give you a quote from Tom Frieden. He was the former CDC director, actually. And he said, if you die from cancer and you also have diabetes, you die from cancer. If you die from COVID and you also had diabetes, you die from COVID. And not all COVID deaths are counted. The true number of COVID deaths is undoubtedly greater than the number of reported deaths. So with that in mind, let's go over to the CDC website, and this is a live graph. So we want to put to bed the false narrative that there's no virus out there, or that whole, you know, thing about deaths. What this shows you is that back in, say, January 2018, we had a bad seasonal flu season. So them little black, red plus signs tell you that there were excess deaths. Now, excess deaths, when you say that, that's death from all causes, no matter what it was. So the bars, you're looking at what happens every year, what's the average in the United States, you know? But when something starts to go beyond the mean, that tells you there's something else going on that is precipitating the higher death rate. So if you look at what happened in the spring in the United States, that's obviously a Herald wave. And then you can see the bump that occurred in summer. But there's an important point to note about this data. It takes 1 to 8 weeks for each week to be updated, just the system that's involved with the reporting data. So if you go back tomorrow or a few days or next week, that data is going to change. The bars, those little red plus signs are probably going to get a little bit higher. So look, with all that information in mind, the U.S. did not have a test for COVID or an accurate PCR test until at least early March, you know? And there were a lot of deaths that occurred in the U.S. that were mistakenly attributed to other issues like the flu or a heart condition that amplified into myocarditis. And, you know, you just dropped dead. So, look, an exclusive report was published yesterday in the Epoch Times, and they have documentation out of China that COVID cases were in hospitals in the vicinity of Wuhan since September of 2019. So it certainly had the opportunity to spread globally beginning in September. And just a little side note, when you look at the gene sequences, there's a gene sequence that matches more closely than the Wuhan lab. And it's a different lab that's further north in China. But both of those strains originated from collections out of caves in Guangdong province, where, you know, the 1918 flu pandemic started. So less thoughts on pandemic and the economy. Herd immunity is a fantasy at this point. Roughly 85 to 95% of the population still susceptible. And that's not even taking into consideration ADE and the fact that the virus has shown its ability to enter the cells of all major organs, including the brain, which causes neurological issues. So the idea that herd immunity will happen at 10 to 20% infection rate is insane. It's nonsense. So by the way, the initial models were correct that came out of the task force at the White House. If restrictions and precautionary measures were put in place to flatten the curve that was designed not to overwhelm the medical infrastructure, give us time to develop medicinal countermeasures, potential vaccine development, we would expect 100,000 to 200,000 deaths by the fall. If we didn't, there would have been a couple of million through the Herald wave. So here we are, 9 months into the pandemic. We got 222,000 dead, and we have a new policy of open everything up and let it rip, and recommended to the White House by a retired radiologist with no background in infectious disease or virologies. The potential for enormous rate of death is looming. It's possible. Right now, it's much better than it was. But remember everything that we just talked about. So the economy, prior to the pandemic, the economy was doing all right. You know, we were keeping holes in the pandemic plugged with repo operations and QE and tax breaks, but we were still not outperforming where we were after the great financial crisis, right? So this week chimed in with the largest monthly trade deficit in history. That's even bigger. It's even bigger with China and Mexico than it was previously. On top of that issue, the U.S. budget's out of control. We got a national debt at $27 trillion, not including unfunded liabilities that are a couple hundred more trillion. It's can kicked every few months to keep the government open. No debt ceiling. We have a bigger government. It's spending more than ever. The Fed is printing more than ever on an unprecedented scale. Nominal interest rates are basically zero, with real rates below zero. The stock markets are elevated because bad economic news is good news, because that guarantees more printing. And there's some pockets of real estate that are elevating home prices in some regions because folks are getting out of the big cities and fleeing Dodge. They're going to the suburbs, the exurbs, and rural America to escape the virus and threats of insurrection. So the economy's underlying fundamentals have been declining since the 80s, quite frankly. GDP, wages, industrial production, velocity of money, which has plunged in the past several months. It's just through the floorboards. Now, 70% of the economy is dependent upon consumer spending. Forget about that. The pandemic's in sync with the fall flu season. Hey, if we have a really bad second wave, whether we agree with it or not, there may be more restrictions and more lockdowns because the coronavirus, frankly, doesn't care about your opinion, and it really doesn't care about immunity certificates. Mm-hmm. And we have a leftist political insurrection with riots, soaring crime rates. There's a growing lack of peace and security and confidence. No matter who was elected, even with the red wave and huge crowds at Trump rallies, duplicating what we covered that. We talked about that back around the 2016 election, and we had misleading poll numbers that favored Hillary. You know, remember that? There's Absolutely. A potential for civil unrest and war by, you know, perpetrated by either side of the political spectrum, no matter what happens. And then we got the Supreme Court justice, which is just adding to an already partisan atmosphere. And unemployment, the chart I got up right now, skyrocketed in mid-March. You know, they're saying 8% is the rate, but realistically, we're somewhere between 10 and 15. New weekly claims are still averaging about 875,000. And despite the jobs returned to the workforce that are being touted as, quote, created jobs, they're not. That's jobs just coming back to the workforce of people who were laid off. But while businesses are attempting to get back to some semblance of normalcy, they're finding out that those jobs may not last long. and about 50% of those jobs will likely mutate into permanence, especially in the services and travel sector. So the payroll protection plan piggy bank is empty. Capitol Hill has no clear path at this point. Could have changed while we did this interview, right? There's no change. There's no physical policy to address this, like maybe some more mortgage relief, eviction relief, some monetary support for the financial plumbing. It's all useless if there's not physical policy that will create sustainable production, jobs, and consumption down the road, because the virus is steering the Fed's zero-bound interest rates and accommodative policy until 2023. I'll end this with one quote from Jim Rickards. He most recently said, "The idea that we're going to bounce back out of this with all this pent-up demand is nonsense. We're going to see 2019 levels output until 2023 at the earliest. We're not going to see 2019 low levels of unemployment until probably 2025. We're not getting back there for 3 to 5 years. So we're looking at a long, slow recovery. And that's if things don't get worse from here, but they could, especially if we get a deadly second wave."
Steph, I'm incredible presentation there. You really did that methodically, and sorry for interrupting you. I wasn't sure if you were done at that one moment, but or just taking a break. But I wanted to just throw something out there at you, and I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, and you addressed it to a certain degree. So I just want you to address this, because people might be thinking this as well. The nuance is that they were able to slow the spreading of the virus. And in hindsight, learning more about the virus has helped more people survive it. I mean, what are your thoughts on all these people who went on the ventilators who shouldn't have gone on ventilators? You're seeing the stories that, you know, their bodies got into extreme inflammation, and then they're pumping oxygen into their lungs where their lungs can't take the oxygen and they're being killed. When you have a lot of doctors saying, hey, if you get the virus, you treat the virus very early, your body doesn't go into this inflammatory shock, and your body's able to fight this and get over it. I mean, it does seem like the therapeutics are coming along to a certain degree, and at least being able to learn about this a little more, it's not so much of a shock to the medical experts, and it's being treated arguably better. And then obviously, you know, the vaccine rabbit hole, if this is constantly mutating, what's that going to mean for, you know, season after season, trying to anticipate what this is going to be like? Maybe the therapeutic side is the way to go, because as soon as you have any sort of symptoms, you attack it very early.
Yeah, it's a lot of rabbit holes, Ken. It's okay. Thank you for listening, you know. Well, as I had mentioned, you know, the medicinals actually have improved. Excuse me. Lockdown served the purpose, but we kind of blew that out in the summer. You know, everyone, you know, there's so long you can lock people up, and we live in a republic, not the communist state of China. The dynamics are very different here, and we got a constitution. So, you know, we just didn't really understand and know what was going on, but it was out there. There were reports and videos coming in from China, for instance, with people dropping dead in the street that were diagnosed with myocarditis that had no symptoms that were presented. So there's a lot of issues we could go into regarding how people were handled. But I think this graphic on the COVID-19 diagnostics, as far as being tested, which, you know, remember, we didn't have a test that worked until March, for instance. But there's a period of time where you're not presenting any symptoms at all, and you've already been infected, and your contagiousness is at its highest point days before your symptoms appear. So there's this issue with saying, well, you catch it early. Well, if you don't know what's happening, how do you catch it early? And that's there's this lag time factor, which is the common denominator through all these metrics. You know, whether it's cases or hospitalizations and then subsequent death. even with the testing and how contagious you are and how you're exposing people and what that dynamic is. For instance, what happened at the Rose Garden at the White House. We'll probably never know unless every single person was traced, contacted, and all their gene sequences were taken. I mean, that's the only way that you can do it. So I guess to answer your question, you know, the vaccines, yeah, obviously there's an issue for so many reasons. The bottom line, it's the common cold. You know, we've never had a vaccine for the common cold. And what they're using is not the traditional vaccine of what most people think, or at least what they're trying to develop, the monoclonal antibodies. You know, there's some nanotechnology in this, and it's kind of like it's going to be altering your DNA to some degree.
I've heard that.
Like, no thank you, I'm not interested. That's just, and there's a lot of other things connected to that. That's a whole nother interview, right? But look, right now what we have is working, but the threat is that it won't work for much longer, and or the cases just get so overwhelming that the system is overwhelmed. And hopefully, if while that's happening, if it does, which it appears to be we're in the first stages since early September, if we get a mutation that shows up on that gene sequence epidemiology, we could be in real trouble. Now, I'm going to add a little bit of something to look forward to. Viruses do burn out. SARS-1 didn't burn out. SARS-1 that's a 10-minute story. But it was traced. It was identified, traced, and contained. Even though it spread a little bit around the world, it didn't get to the degree where we're at now. So we're dealing with SARS 1.0's cousin. It was a lot more virulent. But, you know, just pray that we don't get any serious mutation over the next few months, because if we do, it could be a mess. But at the same time, it could burn out. And, you know, hey, maybe it disappears next spring and summer. That's my hope. But it's like with everything else with this crazy thing. Everything's in hindsight because it's a novel virus. Novel means new. So we're learning as we go along, and that includes the medical community and how they deal with it and how people are treated. So I don't know what to say.
So I'm true.
Yeah, the medical professionals, there is always a bad apple out there, just like there's with police and first responders. There are people who are just not trustworthy and do things that just really aren't good. But overall, you know, people are human, and they tend, you know, death adds another dimension to things, like the World Trade Center's falling.
Steph, you know? Let's segue into precious metals. I know you've prepared a talk for us on this, and some silver and gold charts. Let's go into that, and I'm going to let you take it away. And if I might comment afterwards, but I want you to start it off with where we're at, kind of what we've seen, and where we might expect to go from here, especially as it pertains to significant price points.
Yeah, sure. My preferred topic. Thanks. 2149. We talked about that for years. Anyone that follows Crush the Street, we hit it often in interviews. So I'm just going to, you know, kind of revisit that with a monthly chart. This is from July 31st. The date's really irrelevant as long as it's beyond the breakout point. But you can see I got that big red arrow where it says 2149. And when you drew the fibs from the low back in 2001 up to the high in 2011, 2149 was really important. And when it fell during the financial crisis, primarily because of margin calls, which is what happened with gold, when it did pivot back and it finally got to that 2149 again, there was a rocket shot. But then when it fell and it had its first dead cat bounce, it couldn't penetrate that 2149 like in late 2013, early 2014. And then we traveled all the way down to the low in late 2015. Then that rally we had in 2016, we got to 2113, if I'm not mistaken.
we just didn't hit that 21-49. It was really important that we took that out. So we've had a few more years, and then we had the crazy thing happen in March, right? And that was a bear trap, because it went below that low there, that horizontal line since 2015. And then when it got up there and it broke out, let's zoom in to that 21-49 moment. And it happened within 1 hour, actually. So here you're looking at a block of time in July. And there was a formation that took place once we had a run past 1950, it's a Swiss stair. It's different than a typical staircase, and it's called a Swiss stair because of Swiss watches. Swiss watches have a history of being very accurate. Well, the distance mathematically between the steps are almost to the penny, you know, within a few cents. But that breakout through 2149, you can see what happened between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. on July 21st. And then it came down and retested it the next day. Pivoted back off, we got a pennant. And then here is the real time daily. We're sitting at 24.14. So you can see where we broke out back around 19-20 bucks. Swiss stair, pennant, up to the high, and we've been trending downward. Fibonacci confluence levels, where two of them come together, you tend to get a little bit more resistance, you know, as well as support. So we've basically, you know, that was an extreme overbought condition. But we trended down. We retested that 21.49 a couple weeks back, and we've been trending upward. And we had a situation a couple days ago where it looked like it was going to possibly take it out and run back up to those Fibonacci's around 26 and 27, because the mint, the mint jacked up their numismatic bullion prices on silver eagles by a hefty 25%. That's eventually going to work its way into the stackers market. You know, American silver eagles that don't have mint marks on them, they don't come in a nice little cute package and a certificate of authenticity, just plain old bright uncirculated. I don't think silver is going to break down much at this point. And this support area, when we got that run up to 21.49 in the breakout, that volume here, you can see that's where it eventually came down. And then we had this big buy day here when it retested it. So that's where silver's at. Let's move on to gold. You got anything you want to know about gold, Ken?
Well, let's, and I'd like you to talk about the price points, but on and just a general perspective with what we're seeing with the economy, the money printing, everything that's happening, how does that tie into, you know, gold and silver for that matter here in 2020?
Yeah, okay. Let me hit that after I go through the chart. But I don't know if I got the answer. Yeah. So here's a monthly chart. And that's from July 30th as well. But I just wanted to refresh everyone with the history and of when we took out the 1920. And you can see, I'm going to put my mouse over top this formation here, which is an ascending triangle. That's where that 1380 line is. And it's a Fibonacci, right? So let's move on to the live chart. Oh, I'm sorry. This is actually the US dollar. And I just want to mention this very quickly. Usually folks think that because the dollar goes down, gold goes up and vice versa. That's not necessarily the case. And we had a long period of time where they were intermittently trending together. You know, they were locked at the hip, but something changed. And it specifically happened, in other words, we returned back to what is the default, Okay. And that happened around June 18th and 19th. And I'm highlighting it right here. And I'm not going to go through every candle here and show you the ups and downs on either side of that line, but it's very obvious what occurred here right around mid-June. The dollar started falling again, and gold is having its traditional inverse relationship to it. So if we go into the current daily chart, you know that June 19th date is right where that inverse head and shoulders, where it broke out and started running. So this whole period between the high and that breakout is where the dollar was falling. And this was the overbought condition that began to develop, that I warned for a couple times in late July and early August that, you might want to take some profits if you're trading paper, and look at the volume here that took place. So this whole area right here between 19 and 20 and 21.49 thus far has turned out to be the support area that has been tested twice. Once during August, mid-August, and again with a double bottom big W the third week of September. So we're basically in a channel trending upwards there a bit. And there hasn't been any major breakdown, but the indicators aren't giving me, anything in the near term that's saying, oh, there's going to be a breakout tomorrow, because there's so many differences between scalping, swinging a trade that goes on for days, or long-term core positions, or purchasing physical silver. They're all a different ball game, and they don't necessarily correlate. So that's important to know. But as far as your question, I don't know what's going to happen, but I would say with certainty that no matter who's in the White House, that doesn't change the dynamic of the monetary policy that's currently taking place, which is going to be good to go until at least 23. And no matter which president comes in, then you got the fiscal policy issue to deal with, Both of them are going to spend like no tomorrow. Maybe there was some light at the end of the tunnel a few years back where it appeared that, maybe something will work out. Even if we went to China and said, hey, you owe us almost $2 trillion from bonds back in the 19-teens and 1920s that you defaulted on. And it says it in black and white that even if, the country changes hands to some other political party, you still owe it to us. Just a couple trillion is not really going to make a dent. It's not going to solve the problem by eliminating China's debt. But all of those news events like that, whether it be, hey, Congress came up with a new stimulus, which it's not stimulus. They're just plugging the holes to stop the ship from sinking.
As the holes get bigger.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's like kind of stimulating.
Plugging a part of the hole while the hole continues to expand.
Right. And, the hole's so big, you just can't plug it. So, my expectation, which is common knowledge, I don't think it's anything new, but I think folks thought it would happen sooner and it hasn't. But now, this is the black swan that kind of has put the fork in the pig, so to speak. Global currency reset. But the powers that be don't want to initiate that right now because the world is deep in doo-doo with the pandemic. And we have to emerge from this pandemic first before we throw a global currency reset situation at the population, because that's got its own ramifications with regards to money, currency, and social issues in the economy and different sets of politics in different countries. So it's a crapshoot, but it's going to change. I think gold and silver is going to continue higher, but not as fast as some folks might want to see it. In our early discussion, I don't really want to see a world where we've got $10,000 and $15,000 gold, because it's going to be a mess. So.
Yeah, I know. And even as we talked about in the pre-interview here, who really wants to live in a world like that? I mean, what does that even mean? And look at what we're dealing with 2020, the changes, the lifestyle changes, all the things that we love and we're used to, their freedoms. I mean, look at the world we're dealing with now. And so, and we don't even have, you know, $10,000 gold yet. I mean, imagine what that world might look like. So, I mean, having said that, Steph, wow, what a, you know, informational, jam-packed interview you blessed us with here. I mean, my goodness, this is something that I feel like people can listen to multiple times to really understand, digest, and wrap their minds around. Because this is not information that people are just hearing on one interview after another and just this echo chamber. This is really new information. And I appreciate your efforts and your passion for what you do. So Trader Steph, everyone, Trader Steph, thank you so much for coming on the show. If you would like to share some closing thoughts here, please, please do.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. And everyone, just please be careful out there. You know, don't be a COVIDiot. Protect yourself when you're in a high-risk situation. Be aware of what's going on. Stock up on some basic supplies that you would end up using anyway. Don't go crazy. Just be aware of what's going on. And be honest with yourself and your family. You know, but we're going to get through this. And there's light at the end of the tunnel.
All right, Steph, thank you so much for coming on the show with me today.
Later, Ken.